So before we get started, I have a fun announcement to make. I am going to be at Gen Con August 17th through the 20th in Indianapolis. I'm going to be running games for the Wrecking Crew. So if any of you want to find me, say hello, come by the Wrecking Crew area. I'm going to be there basically all day on Thursday. I'm going to be there in the evening on Friday, and I'm going to be there in the morning and evening on Saturday. Sunday I have off. I'll just be wandering around the vendor area doing whatever. I'm going to bring a whole bunch of packets of the Arcadia card game that was based off of Changeling back in the day. I recently picked those up. We're eventually going to be looking at it. But if any of you see me, want to say hi, I'll be handing those out to anyone who's a listener of the podcast. Come by the Wrecking Crew area, see what's going on. A lot of other people are going to be running a lot of games, and I hope to talk to some of you while I'm there.
The host is riding from Nocnaria, and over the grave of Cluthnabar, Quelta tossing his burning hair, and Neem calling, "Away, come away, empty your heart of its mortal dream. The winds awaken, the leaves whirl round, our cheeks are pale, our hair is unbound, our breasts are heaving, our eyes are agleam, our arms are waving, our lips are apart. And if any gaze on our rushing band, we come between him and the deed of his hand. We come between him and the hope of his heart. The host is rushing twixt night and day, and where is there hope or deed as fair? Quelta tossing his burning hair, and Neem calling, "Away, come away."
Hello again, and welcome to Walking Away from Arcadia. Our topic for today is going to be the She. Elves, as far as the eye can see. I'm Victor Kinzer, and I'm here with my co-host, Simon Eichhornchen. Welcome to the show again, Simon.
I am super excited to talk about the Kith I hate the most.
Oh, come on, no, I can't even pretend. I shouldn't say I hate the She. I don't hate the She. I love the She as a storyteller looking for a really good villain. And I can already tell we've lost half of our listeners. And I apologize for the great offense that we have just laid upon all of them. But at least you know what you're getting into now.
They're She. A great, great, great thing. As long as you don't take them seriously.
Yeah, they're beautifully written. I mean, the She as feudal lords and inspections of privilege and abusers and very occasionally victims and as like looking at what do you do when you're in an ultra vulnerable world and you want to, you know, protect yourself from everything coming at you and those impulses. They're actually a really beautifully elegantly written reflection on all of that. I love the way they're written. I don't love the way they get played because they generally don't get played for all of that. And I, you know, a million and one books to cover the content that any other splat would get in one 90-page splat book never ceases to frustrate me.
Yeah. And in the She's defense, I enjoy them a lot more than I enjoy Ventru.
Oh man, yes. I enjoy them more than I enjoy the Ventru, the Order of Hermes. They're, you know, they're complex and they're meaty and they're engaging in a way that I feel like the other leading splats for the other games really aren't. You know, and fair filter for anyone listening, speaking for myself and I think speaking for Simon, we both tend against the ruling groups in probably all of the games.
Yeah, except maybe Werewolf. I really like the Glasswalkers, but they're not really the rulers either.
No, they're really not. I mean, they're not the bearers of tradition.
No.
No.
They're sort of like the Autumn She, who are probably the most redeemable She as player characters.
Well, and so that actually gets us into our first topic, the Autumn She. And we talked about this a little bit in our review of C20. What are the Autumn She?
In C20, they broke down the Shi Kith into two distinct kiths with the same name, but different characteristics, kind of. And you have the divide is between the Arcadian Shi and the Autumn Shi. The Arcadian Shi are the returning Shi from Arcadia. They're new to the world as of roughly 800 or 900 years, give or take. Their affinity is for time, and so they get a, you know, kith bonus to buying the time realm and rolling on it. They are especially weak against banality triggers and cold iron and all the trappings of banality, where the Autumn Shi, on the other hand, stayed behind on Earth during the interregnum and underwent the changeling way, and there were some Arcadian Shi who also stayed behind but died off because they refused to undergo the changeling way. And the Autumn Shi reincarnate, just like commoners and Ghislaine do. Their affinity is for the Fae, so they interact with chimerical reality a lot better than the Arcadian Shi do. And the Autumn Shi have all of the same benefits of being Shi as the Arcadian Shi do. Their frailty, however, is because they are of the world, humanity finds them approachably fascinating rather than just fascinating. And their flaws written in such a way that they can spawn stalkers by interacting with humans pretty much accidentally and all the time, which is a lot more interesting from a storyteller's perspective than you are terrified of everything.
It is. I also like that because they are of the world, they take up a space for Shi out and about in the world. I mean, there's definitely a place for the Shi Lord who has no empathy and is walled away next to his balefire, but having an Autumn Shi who's out in the world and taking care of it and ruling, there still dreams of rulership, although I kind of like the idea that they are less feudal and a little more modern. I think that makes sense for having blended themselves with human souls and having evolved with some of human ideas about leadership. And I think that also creates a place for an archetypical concept that was lacking among changelings, and that is more, I don't know that equitable is quite the right term, but less authoritarian leadership. And especially as the argument about are we traditionalists, are we the bearers of new wondrous creative things is, I'd say, even more highlighted in C20 than it has previously been. I think that space is very importantly held by the Autumn Shi.
Right. And the Shi's reason for being, apart from being rulers, is politics. And I feel like the Shi are the people who can reliably trick vampires should they choose to stoop.
I completely agree. And one thing that I would have always liked to see more developed is the huge political advantage of being always forgotten, of being inspiration, just wisping, moving inspiration. And, oh, you're this ridiculously old, powerful Ventru prince or La Sombra archbishop. That's nice for you, but to extend your power, you still have to influence mortals and even less powerful vampires that I can inspire, as dangerous as that is. It can still be done. And the ability to maneuver when you have the obfuscation of the mists is really powerful, and I would love to see more stories told about that, because I think that's where the Shi's power really lives. I think the idea of that is terrifying, given the way politics works in the world of darkness.
Yes, and it's another one of those interesting cases, too, where I think the one place where the Shi are eclipsed in politics is going to be when interacting with mages whose Bolowick is politics, because humans are always better in World of Darkness, and I really think the technocracy should be better than the Shi in this case.
Well, and also, if you play the technocracy the way they're written, the Xi aren't invisible to the technocracy. The technocracy, a technocrat wouldn't look at a Xi and see an elf. They wouldn't think of them as an elf, but they would absolutely register them as a reality deviant and as an other dimensional being infesting and, controlling a human. And they have many abilities to detect all of the energies that being fey bring to the world. Because of the mists, they're not going to see and experience the fey as they are, but the mists aren't going to come and erase that reading on that device right there that says, I don't know what that is, but it is full of chaotic, corruptive, awful quintessence. We gotta fix it. That takes away a big advantage that the Fae take for granted.
Yes. So, leaving aside extra fey politics, the politics that the Xi tend to occupy themselves with, often as a glamorous act, they would tell themselves, they may have created the court system. They would claim they created the court system. They created the divide between the Seelie and the Unseelie. And that kind of carried away with itself when they left Earth. The commoners developed different ideas about what it is to be Seelie or Unseelie, and part of the Accordance War, at least in America, was the returning Arcadian Xi reimposing the true meaning of being Seelie or Unseelie on the commoners. The Xi are very traditionalist, which you may think would make them very opposed, naturally, to the Unseelie court. However, several wide swaths of the Xi kith are broken up into houses that are traditionally Unseelie. When you take away the capacity to rebel against the institution that the Xi propped up and made extremely beneficial to themselves, what do the Unseelie Xi rebel against?
That's kind of the question. I always found the courts to be difficult, and I think, if anything, C20 has made that a little more complicated by drawing a direct corollary between the Dark Ages courts and the modern Seelie Unseelie courts, with actually writing in a Changeling the Dreaming book that there used to be four and now there are two, and you're left wondering how do they map, although that mapping isn't that difficult to figure out. It still makes you wonder. So when I think about what the Unseelie Xi would have to rebel against, and then I look at the Unseelie houses, I almost think the Unseelie houses, when you look at the history of the Fae, are the more traditional houses. When you look back at what the Fae were in the past, they started as nightmares. They started as crawling out of the chaos of the world, wanting to destroy reality in graceful wicked masks, and those fair folk are clearly meant to be the Fomorians. And then in Dark Ages, Fae, they're really pretty creepy and archetypical. And they're broken up into four seasons, and their motivations are a bit more ineffable. And then in the modern era, suddenly there's musing, suddenly there's a more, I'll say, productive relationship with humanity that's hinted that maybe that existed before Dark Ages Fae, and then the Fae leaving messed it up, but it's only hinted. And so I almost feel like what the Unseelie Fae are rebelling against, at least the Unseelie Xi are rebelling against, is the rules that say you don't get to be what you used to be. We've become something else. Now you have to be that. When you look at House Balor, when you look at the Leonin, that lens is the only thing that even vaguely makes House Dannon being a little bit Unseelie make any sense to me at all. And even then, it doesn't map when you think about that they're supposed to be the closest things to the Tuatha and super counter to the Fomorians. So, yeah, I don't entirely understand the court to she mapping, if I'm going to be totally honest.
Yeah, before Changeling 20th hit, the old way to examine how the Xi and the courts interacted was to look at
the Xi impulses. They had this thing called a political impulse. It may have come up in Shining Host or a different book. I don't remember which, because there are so damn many Xi books. But the impulses were one of the few things that came up in those books that I looked at, and they made sense almost right away to me, because they're refinements on how the Xi interact with the courts. And so it broke down into, for the Sili, who are doubly traditionalist, being both Xi and Sili, they broke down into two-ish groups. Their political interest was around how to interact with the commoners. So the traditionalist movement, they were like, no, this is a feudal system, go screw yourselves. And the modernists came about after the Accordance War, pretty sure. But they favored sharing power between the commoners and the Xi in some limited fashion. There were also radical modernists, but they were an extreme minority and basically outcasts. But House Gideon became a modernist faction, more or less, with the coming of King David, because King David instituted the Parliament of Dreams, which was a power-sharing scheme that left the Xi in control, but did make some concessions to the commoners. The really interesting thing about the Xi impulses was that the Unseelie and Seelie Xi impulses had nothing to do with each other. The Unseelie political impulses were all reflections of the Unseelie having been out of power for the entire interregnum, and so their political impulses revolved around trying to restore seasonal rule, which was the thing that just did not happen after the Shattering. And then there were, I don't remember what they were called, but restorationists who, rather than restoring seasonal rule, wanted to put the Unseelie court in power for an equal amount of time to the amount of time that the Seelie ruled. And then there were radical restorationists who wanted to rule forever, just completely displace the Seelie entirely. And that framing made the Unseelie houses and the Seelie houses make a lot more sense to me personally, because it was really hard to see how they interacted with the commoners' understanding of what it was to be Seelie or Unseelie. And the commoners' understanding is what most players get, because it's what's in the core book, at least before C20.
Yeah, and I don't know, I feel like the commoner understanding, and my understanding of the commoner understanding, especially if this is based off early Changeling books, is the dream versus nightmare divide. And when the Fomorians were a far-off, obscure thing that was only there for, you know, the adventurous storyteller to pluck, and the Thalane were a weird afterthought in a couple side books, that dream-nightmare divide worked. Now that the Fomorians and the Thalane are so much more front and center in C20, I really don't like that divide, because it turns the Unseelie into half Fomorian fodder. And there's really only one group that should be that, ever, and that's House Balor. And they did a lot of work, actually, in making the other Unseelie houses less atrocious in C20. The biggest example of that being House Leonin, where they're still kind of dark and disturbing, but playable. You know, so I like the traditionalist rebel divide more. It just gets complicated, and it doesn't map perfectly to the new understanding of glamour and how it's impacted some of the houses. It maps, I think, relatively well to the commoners, ironically enough, because it's not how they tended to understand it previously. So, to say this all gets into the messy, complicated, and consistent narrative that we've always talked about Changeling having, I think the courts went from being four courts in Dark Ages Fae to two courts in the modern setting, and that's actually tied together in C20. But if you go back to Dark Ages Fae, they talk about the courts and the saining process. Saining in modern C20 is more tied to coming into your own, being brought into changeling society. You might be saned into a house, but you aren't saned into a court. Everyone has both courts. But in Dark Ages, you were saned and brought into one of the courts, and the Fae who weren't saned to one of the courts were kind of this weird, strange, different thing. And part of saning is naming. That's what saning means, is giving definition to something. And for the longest time, I struggled with the Seelie-Unseelie divide because there were all these different definitions. It seemed political, yet it was clearly a metaphysical thing that directly manifested out of some cosmological root and impacted your character directly. And it did it differently for different groups of Galane. And so I was always like, which is it? Which is it? Is it political or is it cosmological? But if you go back to that root and you go, oh, it's both, because literally it is political, but it's political channeled through the ritual of saining. And so if you had this saining ritual that defined these four courts, and then there just wasn't enough magic to maintain that, and there wasn't enough magic even to maintain the coherent definition and the distinction between Fae, and you see that breaking down, I could imagine some saning ritual early on, maybe after the shattering, so only a handful of Autumn She, and maybe a few She that refused to go all the way through the Changeling Way in the early days that eventually died off, took part in as basically triage. To be like, okay, we can't maintain all this anymore, we're losing our ability to sane and name and give manifestation. We have to reduce the way we sane Fae. We have to reel this in. And so all of these concepts from these four disparate courts all get shoved together into two, and even then you can't quite sane a Fae and have them be totally archetypical of one court, and so you get into this mixed jumping around between courts dynamic. I suddenly see all of the messiness of the courts as actually being a canon intentional thing. And I think if you were to seed that story and talk about it not making sense and then being contradictory in the world, it suddenly becomes really interesting in a way that just trying to glean what did the developers mean is not interesting for me. And all of that just sort of came together as we were talking about this, and I thought about that Dark Ages connection they put in C20.
Yeah, that's a really helpful way to look at it in the post-C20 universe. The other way that she are divided, apart from being into Arcadian and Autumn, being Seelie or Unseelie, being different impulses within those, they also have houses, which are more or less a feudal holdover. Some of the houses are broken along interestingly strange cultural lines. And one of the things I noticed going back over the house descriptions that are in C20 and comparing them to the house descriptions in the variety of books of houses is that I don't know whether it was a function of limited word count or whether they wanted to make the houses fit their court a little bit better, because each house has a predominant court that it belongs to. But a lot of the Unseelie houses are a bit less monstrous than they used to be.
Which, I mean, I have to say, I think part of the decision to do that is, in the old days, the Unseelie houses tended to fall into, like, Bali, Nefandi, Spectre territory. And it's something that most of the people I knew who thought Changeling was light and fluffy and, oh, the Dauntain are the worst thing in the game, they never really knew about, because the Unseelie houses were also in obscure source books. There was a whole book that was nothing but Unseelie houses. Most of them made an appearance in the first edition Shadow Court book, but those weren't books casual players ever read. And so when you did read them, they did a lot of things that in the other games would have disqualified them as PC fodder.
And the Xi's whole reason for being is politics. They would say that they invented the court structure, and they are deeply embedded in it, so much so that the Dreaming gives them additional birthrights and frailties, house boons and flaws, and those are all contingent on house membership. But basically every Xi is a member of a house, so it goes without saying. And all of the houses are moderate to strongly affiliated with a court, except for two-ish. And while the Xi can flip their court affiliation as much as they want to, which is more than they say they would, if you ask them, they would never flip their court affiliation. But in reality, they do it at least as much as most others, which is rare to common, depending on the individual. But the houses themselves have a political alignment that encourages one of the court affiliations over the others.
The air fairly crackled with glamour, and it seemed like all the balefires flared briefly. The most aware of us swear they heard a distant rumble like thunder over the horizon. And then the Xi returned. How they came varied. Some rode out of the Dreaming in great processions, only taking mortal forms after their arrival. Some simply woke in the mortal shells they'd chosen. Don't ask me what happened to the humans who owned those bodies. Some say those mortal souls are frolicking in Arcadia right now. For all I know, the humans were sent out of the world entire. Or maybe they're locked in some corner of that hybrid mind. Roland Tanara, a venerable satyr, as recorded by Gloria, a boggin of no import.
We are going to quickly run through the houses, because there are a lot of them, and more now that C20's out. So, starting at the top, we have House Icene. They're a predominantly Unseelie house, based on the Alfar of Norse myths. Somehow they're from Arcadia. I don't know how that works. And their superpowers put them in line with druids. They can talk to animals in a way the other fae can't.
The next house is House Aileel, that has kind of an interesting backstory. House Aileel is part of a pair of houses. There were twins, Aileel and Eluned, and they were very close. Aileel leaned towards being Unseelie, Eluned leaned towards being Seelie, and Aileel, they're known as liars. Their boon is that they subtract one from difficulty on manipulation rolls, and they're very manipulative, and they're very wrapped up in politics, I would say more so than the other Unseelie houses. But they have a very close relationship with the house of their founder's twin, Eluned, who are technically Seelie. So they have a little bit more canon story set up than a lot of the other houses, especially a lot of the other Unseelie houses that sometimes really just exist to be a bit monstrous.
Which is a good line into Baelor, who is monstrous. They are the children of the defeated Firbolg after the Tuatha De Dana came into Ireland. They were hostage taken and kept in rulership of Connaught, but they were forcibly interbred with the Tuatha, producing Baelor Xi, who are in some way monstrously deformed. That's the word they use to describe it. It's not mine. And they end up getting wrapped up in a huge part of Changeling's metaplot. If you go all the way back to Wicked Masks, the Balorian Crusade was a term used to describe the fair folk who came into reality to undo it. And from there, they evolved along their path as fair folk, then fae, then changelings, always harboring their hatred of the children of Dana and working hard to make sure that they suffered in ways that could never be conclusively proven to be Baelor's fault.
And then we have House Beaumain. Beaumain is They're a house of monster hunters. They hunt the Thalane. They have a very occultist aesthetic about them. They're also prophets. Truth be told, if we're going to be completely honest about this, they're kind of a weird Skathic clone. The only big difference between Beaumaine and Skathic is Beaumaine doesn't have the strong tie to humanity, and instead of being crazy berserkers, they're occultists. But really, if you just flip out those two variables and leave everything else the same, you end up with kind of the same house. They hate the Thalane. They don't bring up the Adheen, which is kind of unusual. Their boon is wrapped up in being able to detect the Thalane and see them. Their flaw is that they can more easily be seen by the Thalane and by the Shadow Court, which is the other odd thing about them. Their cosmological supernatural dynamics involve the Shadow Court, even though the Shadow Court have been reframed as a more modern political phenomenon as opposed to what it was presented as before, which is an older political phenomenon, but still not the same cosmological thing that the Seelie and Unseelie were. So they're a little odd. They're a lot like Skathak. That's really Beaumaine in a nutshell.
And then with C20, we got the official introduction of House Dannon. They're an Unseelie house. They're one of the few that has a weak court affiliation. They've primarily resided in the Dreaming rather than on Earth, and their whole reason for being is wrapped up in navigating the Dreaming, finding and maintaining Trods. And the interesting thing about them is their flaw gives them a reverse Mists dynamic. So where changelings have forgotten their supernatural origins, more or less. Like, they all know they're changelings, but they don't remember all of their lives back to when they weren't changelings. She of House Dannon remembers quite a bit of her supernatural life, but has trouble remembering mundane details about her life on Earth. At appropriately dramatic moments, she will forget the name of her girlfriend, or where she parked her car, or what her job is. And if she botches the role to remember it, she has a complete amnesic experience of it and has to relearn that information. And then there's House Duran. They're witches. If you take a slua and a boggin and slam them together, you get this kind of a she. They are impeccably hospitable and extremely vengeful. If you offend their sense of propriety, they are compelled to seek you down and do terrible things to you until you have learned your mistake.
Next is House Dougal. Dougal is interesting in that they are not particularly engaged by leadership. They're she, they kind of lead, but they're all about craftsmanship. They're kind of a noble mixture of a knocker and a boggin. Of all the houses, they probably changed the most between the classic canon and C20. They used to be craftspeople who made fine swords and armor and shields, and they were smiths. So they weren't as technically minded as knockers, but they weren't as sort of mundanely minded as boggins. And in that way, they did kind of fit a different niche. Lord Dougal, the house founder, invented steel. There's this really compelling story in the Book of Houses where they were first really written up in detail about him inventing steel and the damage he did to himself doing that. And it was really all pretty interesting. In C20, they wrapped them up in maker culture and the creativity of crafting and creation, which, given the shift in human culture, makes a lot of sense. What's weird about Dougal is instead of telling a story about the old traditional craftsmen reinventing themselves into maker culture and, you know, making it a parallel to the unshaped coming out of the wild, or the, you know, firstborn sort of beginning to mingle with humanity and making changelings, or changelings, you know, embodying into humans. Instead of making it about that adaptation, they just retconned their whole story. Dougal had a whole backstory about the Shi who stayed behind. There were far more of them with Dougal than other houses, but they all died out because prior to C20, You know, any she who stayed behind died. Then as of C20, the she who stayed behind became Autumn She. So that got really heavily altered. And instead of telling a story about their transformation, they intrinsically altered their flaw. It used to be that all Dougal She had some sort of physical disability that they could craft some sort of, you know, artificial limb or something that would help them compensate. And so it forced them to use their craft on themselves. Instead, they turned it into this flaw where you sort of become a chimerical Borg. And as you go up in rank, which again is unusual because the old write-up on them is that they cared more about craft than rank. But as you go up in rank, random body parts are replaced by chimerical body parts. Sometimes they make them themselves, but generally it just happens. And their whole backstory was retconned. So Dougal is a little bit strange depending on which version of them you want to use, or if you want to go ahead and actually make the movement forward to 2017 a transformation instead of a has always been that way thing. The next house is Ailuned, which I mentioned earlier. They are the companion house to Ailill. Ailuned is interesting in that they are Seelie, but no one really trusts them because they're still very close to House Ailill. Their founder loved her sister very, very much, and they still, you know, feel very close to this unseelie house. They're sorcerers, and the thing that makes them really quirky, and it really feeds into why no one else trusts them, is House Gwydion's boon is that they can always tell when someone else is lying, but they can't tell with House Ailuned. Even though Ailill is the house that's good at lying, a Gwydion can still tell when someone from Ailill is lying, but they can't tell when someone from Ailuned is lying. And an Ailuned will stand there and be like, no, I'm Seelie, you can trust me. And most of the time, they are trustworthy. But then, not always. And this house that's used to always knowing whether or not they can trust someone can't really know with Ailuned. And everyone else that goes to Gwydion to, you know, do those readings for them, they can't really tell with Ailuned. So even though they're Seelie, they're one foot in the unseelie sort of Seelie. And they just are constantly getting into political schemes, and they're just really driven to find out other people's secrets and mysteries. Their flaw is wrapped up in that, and it just gets them into a lot of trouble, and it does not ever engender any trust from anybody else.
That brings us to House Fiona. They're Seelie, they're driven by passion, they're probably the most she-like, mythologically she-like, changeling she-house in the game. They have a direct correlation to the satyrs, and they are immune to fear of any type. Even the fear of sticking your hand in the fire because you might get burned. That doesn't mean anything to them. And the reason that Fiona is immune to fear is that they are obsessed with love. They will justify ignoring any fear to themselves in a way that grants them a supernatural ability to resist it, as long as they can wrap it up in, but this gets me closer to this thing I love. And they also have a relationship with the Fianna werewolves, sometimes, depending on whether or not it's retconned in the version of the book you're reading. And then there's House Gwydion. They are also Seelie warriors. They're more troll-like than Fiona is. As Victor said, they can detect lies. And Gwydion is very firmly entrenched in Concordian politics. Their house is currently the ruling house. They count High King David as one of their members, and they hold the majority of the power in the Concordian experiment.
And that brings us to House Leonin. Leonin is probably the most monstrous house that was ever written in the original canon. They're known as muses, they're patrons of the art. The thing that makes them really horribly monstrous is in their original write-up, they had to perform rhapsody once a week. And rhapsody is where you imbue a dreamer with glamour. They produce some form of art. It is the peak of their capability, their inspiration. It will be the best thing they ever create. And then you destroy it in front of them. And you drain all of their potential and glamour out of them. I mean, everything. Victims of Rhapsody are left empty husks. A lot of them become autumn people. A lot of them commit suicide. You're basically always destroying a dreamer. And the idea that every Leonin had to do this once a week was pretty insane. A group of Leonin could share a dreamer because you can do a group Rhapsody, so that mitigates that a little bit. If they didn't do this, they aged very, very quickly and died, and the Rhapsody would undo that aging. They have basically the same flaw, except now it's just about feeding. They still have to take glamour from a dreamer much more frequently than other Fae, which still becomes pretty parasitic, but it can be any form of harvesting, and Rhapsody just, if they Rhapsody, they're not going to have to feed again for a very long time. That will, you know, stave off the aging for a pretty long period of time, or undo quite a bit of the aging that has happened. So they still have to feed a lot. They're still very parasitic. They're still wrapped up in the arts, but they're playable now as opposed to worse than most Nefandi. So it was a pretty good change. And then that brings us to Liam. Liam is a Seely house, and Liam is the one and only house of she that are wrapped up in the church. They are Christian. They've sort of infiltrated the church, and they've become a Christian form of she. It's kind of a fascinating way to look at any Fae, because the Fae myths were so heavily transformed by the Catholic Church. And that's something that isn't always inspected in Changeling, although it's much more heavily emphasized in C20. I've never been drawn to play a Liam, but it's the sort of thing where I could very easily see myself using them as NPCs. And if you really want to lean into what did the church really do to the Fae, how did they transform them, was it an act of violence, did the Fae, you know, sneak their way in and get the upper hand and they avoided being turned into demons like the church did with so many other things, or what really happened there, there's a lot of interesting story potential with Liam. It just gets into a space with Christianity that the rest of the game doesn't necessarily explore, so you have to really want to dive into that territory.
Then we have House Scathic, the other house that stayed behind during the Interregnum. Liam also stayed behind. Scathic stayed behind on Moss, and they were motivated by a vision of the future that it's never quite clear whether the leadership alone got it or if the entire house got it, but they saw a horrible, desolated future, and rather than wrap themselves up in the dreaming like the Shi always do and usher along that future, because that's what fate wants, they decided to fight fate, and they stayed behind voluntarily. They underwent the Changeling Way ritual like House Liam did, like the Commoners did. Both of these houses are autumn Shi. They reincarnate properly. Rather than like House Beaumain or House Varric, they are not cool oracles. They are hot-blooded oracles. They are compelled to seek out excellence in combat, and they treat it with a kind of reverence that you might get out of a church, except they're in the middle of a fight.
And that brings us to the last house, House Varric. Varric is fun because they're both Unseelie and oracles. They're the only oracular Unseelie house. They hail from Russia, which is interesting. It kind of gets into the same. They're from Arcadia, but they're from Russia, which I suppose is no odder than the Greek myths being from Arcadia. They're kind of weird in that they weren't exiled from Arcadia. They sort of orchestrated their entrance and exit from Arcadia based on their oracular visions. Their talent plays out in battle, and they're really kind of manipulative. They kind of only exist, if I'm going to be honest, so that you have an Unseelie set of oracles. In a lot of ways, the themes of the house reflect some pretty core she dynamics. Their big flaw is that they're incapable of feeling. They have no emotion whatsoever, which is what happens to the she on a certain level as they move into the dreaming. They lose any and all empathy, any and all ability to relate, and they become more and more alien. So this kind of falls into that same dynamic, except they just have it in a more amped up way while they're not influenced by being in the dreaming.
So that's the she houses and the courts and the impulses. Now yeah, we get to gestalt.
You really have to cover a lot for the she to make much sense. Unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Unfortunately or fortunately, they're, on one hand, really standard leaders. On the other hand, infinitely complex. I oscillate on whether I love them or absolutely can't stand them, really depending on the day and whether I'm storytelling or playing.
Right. I keep joking with my players that if we get desperate enough for another player, I'm going to invite somebody we all know who would play a great she, and I would rage quit storytelling after about the third game.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, I still love the visit where I got to cameo in your game and you had my partner play a she, and my partner is just the sweetest, most endearing individual ever, and man, he just did not have the Machiavellian cruelty necessary, even to play the Skathaki he was playing. Like, he was so much kinder than he should have been.
Yeah, he had a good death.
He did have a good death.
So, bringing that all together into how to use the she in the setting as provided. I have this running thread in the back of my mind whenever I'm writing a she or using a she, which is rare because I don't like them very much. But I'm never sure whether originally they were written to be playable characters or if they were written to be NPC antagonists. As an American, I can look at this alien force coming in and colonizing basically all of America, and the cultural gravitas there is that they're the bad guys, even though technically that's me. So it's a complicated mental space.
Yeah, it really is. When I said earlier I oscillate on whether I love them or hate them, depending on the day and, you know, whether I'm playing or storytelling, I actually love the she as a storyteller. I love using them, especially as villains. I think Balor and Leonin and even some of the Seelie houses make really compelling villains. There are only a couple houses I would ever play. I'd play a Skathak. I'd play a Dougal. Yeah, that's my list. But as we said earlier in the episode, I hate all of the leadership groups in the World of Darkness. I recognize they are necessary to create a round and complete narrative, but I don't like them, and I don't play them. I was forced to play Eventru once, and it was terrible, and I feel the same way about most of the she houses. But as a storyteller, wanting to tap into the weird, messy relationship that Americans have with autocratic leadership, I think they're amazing. I don't see them used that way very often. You know, if you look at the Changeling 20th anthology, Changeling 20th really talks about them in that sort of feudal, autocratic, kind of terrible way. They only show up that way in the anthology once, and it's in a very non-centered way. They're not the center of that story. They're not even really the main antagonist. And it's kind of confusing to me. I look at American culture. I look at the rise of dynastic leadership. And where did the rise of dynastic leadership in America start? It started with Kennedy. Prior to Kennedy, we didn't have dynastic leading families. And then after Kennedy, we have the Bushes. We have the Clintons. And now we have Kennedys coming up again in response to our current political situation with Trump. I've seen so many stories about the Kennedy that's in the House of Representatives. I forget his first name. And one of the female Kennedy, I suppose it would be grandchildren by now, maybe great-grandchildren, I'm not certain. But they're running as well. And I see these articles from people like, oh, this is our great new hope. And I'm like, oof, you know what you're talking about here, right? And no, people don't really know what they're talking about, but that's in the back of their mind. That's their dream, their, I love this lineage, these families of leaders that I can identify with that can tell me how to live. And no, we don't like that, but we do. And it's this weird, messy relationship. And when did it come back? It came back with the moon landing that was ultimately the final manifestation of Kennedy's great dream, Kennedy's great mission for us as a country. And I just love all of that potential there. For me, that's just quintessentially she and quintessentially American story, which is what Changeling's all about.
And you get into an interesting place as a storyteller when you're expanding a little bit on what Changeling and the American story are, because Changeling's take on it in broad strokes is the story of white America. It nods to minority groups, but it doesn't really get deep into it at all. And when it does do its nod, it's always from the perspective of how does this group interact with the majority group. It's not this group is self-evident and has their own motivations. And in our game, the one that I'm storytelling, our group is made up of Cathayn, of Nunahi, and of Orisha, which are a homebrew group of spirits that came over from a specific region in West Africa. And seeing these groups interact in a historical, more or less true to historical setting, you get the white groups, the Cathayn, really getting involved in oppressing the non-white groups. And then the Shi return, and they do exactly the same thing that the commoner Cathayn were doing to everybody else, to the commoners. And it's not a story you can tell with all players, but it's a story that I think is really helpful, especially for thoughtful, but for white people to have to consider, because it's a thing we don't normally encounter, and it's a thing we should understand.
Yeah, it really is. And the thing that I think is fascinating about the Shi, and you know, when I'm having one of my days where I really like the Shi, I don't necessarily like them like, oh, I would like a Shi that I met, but I like them as a narrative. Are days when I really want to inspect privilege, because the Shi are just pure, distilled, manifest privilege. And to kind of flip on that colonization dynamic, I've always liked the idea of taking a Shi, especially one of the hardcore leadership houses like Gwydion, and putting them in Hawaii. And you know, we've talked a little bit about the Menehune on this show, and I've talked with Simon about them separately. The Menehune have some problems in the way they're structured, but the thing that's interesting about them is that the indigenous culture of Hawaii, while definitely colonized and definitely altered and modified by the coming of white people, they're still kind of the dominant culture on the islands. You know, white people are definitely a minority in Hawaii. I have a number of friends who've lived there, and it's a weird, bizarre, imperfect relationship on all sides that you don't really see anywhere else in America. And the idea of putting a Shi there, where colonization has absolutely happened, but it hasn't happened the same way, and it hasn't resulted in the same kind of power dynamics, and, you know, put them up against some ali'i. And I love the idea of how they would react when they try to pull out their sovereign, and the ali'i go, not only am I Ghislaine, but I'm also full of glamour in a way you could only ever pray to be, and I'm noble. No, really, slow your roll, buddy. And I think there's a lot of potential there to inspect how would the Shi react to that, because that's something that they never have to face. And I think if you play the Shi with an eye to looking at those possibilities, those opportunities to kind of pull their legs out from underneath them, I think they can be super interesting. It's just when I've run into players, they want to be the Paladin, they want to play Camelot, they want to play standard Shi politics, which I tend to not be as interested in.
Yes, and the Shi lacking a cultural context to understand what's going on around them in Hawaii is a little bit the way the Shi are depicted as being early on during the resurgence in one of the many, many side books about the Shi. That actually was the book that got me interested in the Shi, because it introduced some of the things they came back with. They have their own martial art, the Hero's Halo, which is really good. They also have... They came back with the Kronos Realm, which did a little bit more in 2nd edition than it does in C20, but anyway. And in 2nd edition, the Shi had this problem that was described in that side book, but nowhere else, which was unfortunate, that they don't understand linear time. They came out of Arcadia with a complete understanding of the strange way time works in dreams and myths, where everything is happening all the time, or everything is really distant and you have lots of clarity on it. Think of the way the oracles in Dante's Inferno worked, where they couldn't see the present, but they could see very far away from themselves in the past and future as if it was happening to them. And that's kind of the way the Shi were described as being. All events were happening with emotional immediacy to them, and the Kronos Realm reflected their understanding of how they, in their newly acquired human forms, moved through human linear time, where a Shi with no dots in Kronos would not understand why day is different from night, why winter is different from summer, or why any particular thing needs to happen at any particular time. A Shi with 5 dots in it had such a good understanding of mortal time and the way time works in reality that they had a built-in defense mechanism against mages using the time sphere. That perspective of time being really strange naturally and ordered time being abhorrent and hard to understand, while like it is really hard to play and kind of destructive to group dynamics, it explained to me in a way that their flaw as written, their banality frailty, didn't explain why the Shi acted the way they do, why they are what they are. Because they were out of the world for hundreds of years and came back and immediately picked up where they left off. They started enforcing oaths on commoners who didn't remember them because they'd been reincarnated dozens of times at this point, and remembrance didn't stretch that far back. They came back and immediately started trying to subjugate whatever land they saw because it was theirs, as is natural, as it was when they left. And all of that makes a lot more sense if you don't understand that time passing has a meaning.
Well, and the other thing that the time dynamic always reminded me of is it acts as a very strong signpost to the fact that the Shi are the direct inheritors of the Firstborn, are the direct inheritors of the Fair Folk from Exalted. This might be a bit apocryphal, I don't have confirmation of this, but I've talked with people who have said, you know, oh yeah, back in the day when they were planning the 5 World of Darkness games, because those were planned coherently, they at least had a rough concept of vampire, werewolf, I think it was wizard originally, ghost and fairy or fae were the original working names of the 5 games. They had them all roughly sketched before Vampire even came out. And that the idea of the Exalted time period was also roughly sketched. I don't know that they had any idea they were ever going to do a game about that, but as a world Bible thing of this is where all these supernaturals came from, that concept was already planned. And that's why I like, especially with the Fae, because changelings are hard to understand, I actually do like the Exalted precursor stuff for at least looking at what are these crazy things. And the Fair Folk in Exalted are just these incredible, unshaped, incoherent things that clawed their way out of chaos and barely have a relationship with creation initially. They actually think structured form is abhorrent, and that I don't even understand time thing for me really evokes back to that, as opposed to the commoners, where the prequel vibe I got from them is changelings from Dark Ages Fae, where you have the firstborn, where they either bred with humans or left their own children to be raised by humans or stole human children to be raised by Fae, and all of those things sort of became changelings. And those Fae eventually turned into the commoners, I think, is the intention. You know, that's a very different lineage. They would have a much closer relationship to humanity, which makes the changeling way make sense. But thinking of the Shi as these super alien things, and thinking of, like, House Varric and I Can't Feel Emotion, the Fair Folk are described as having no emotion in Exalted. They had graces, which basically represented their way of faking emotion. They were constantly playing the sociopathy game. The I'm sociopathic, I don't feel things, but I've learned how to fake it to get by in the world. And thinking of the Shi as the inheritors of those beings is compelling for me. I love playing alien, especially alien now wrapped up in human. And, you know, that lineage, that idea, I find a lot more compelling than we're nobles, we're leaders, we're this ideal of Camelot. I can live without that in my life, to be totally honest.
All right. So we've talked about the way the Shi are in the game. Let's talk a little bit about what the Shi are based on, which is a thing that exists that uses the same name.
So, the Shi are based on the Aoshi from Celtic mythology or Gaelic mythology. Exactly where these myths end and begin is a little ambiguous and would require more research that I can really say to have with a great deal of authority, but the myths are most commonly associated with the fairy mounds or Shi mounds of Ireland. And just the straight up term Shi, a standalone term, refers to those mounds. It doesn't refer to a class of beings. And then the term appears over and over and over again tied to other terms. So Ban Shi is a reference to the Shi. The Slua Shi is the original term for the Slua. The Ao Shi refers to all of the fair folk of Ireland. And there are several other terms and combinations that the Bean Shi, which are different from the Ban Shi, that make reference to this, but it's always some sort of reference to the Fae. The Shi themselves in the game, though, are obviously nobles, whereas all of these other fair folk could be any number of different myths, and tended not to be terribly noble. When you got a little farther into Scandinavian territory, you ran into elves that were probably a little closer to the changeling Shi. And the closest thing to the Shi in, you know, Irish mythology are the Tuatha De Danann, who were these great magical people who had cast out the Firbolg from Ireland, and the Firbolg had cast out the Fomorians from Ireland. I think the Fomorians were the first people in the invasion cycle. And then eventually the Tuatha were cast out by the Milesians, and the Milesians were humans, basically, the people of Ireland. And when the Tuatha were cast out, they went underground into these mounds and were diminished and became all of the myriad spirit folk that then populated the lands of Ireland. And again, exactly geographic lines where those myths end and transform get a little hazy. It's not a precise thing, but these myths are commonly known to center on Ireland, maybe a little bit in Scotland as well. But elves in general certainly extend well up into Scandinavia. So that's clearly where this invasion cycle comes from, where the Tuatha and the Fomorians in the game come from in Changeling 20th. That connection was even more strongly paralleled in the way the Fomorian backstory was presented. You have, you know, the inanime sort of stuck in there in between the Fomorians and the Tuatha and the Shi. But that's kind of the rough mythology that is being mirrored into Changeling and then heavily changed. And so it kind of leaves you going, well, what does that really mean about the Shi? Like, what can I use from that? In truth, I don't have a good answer for that question, because the Tuatha aren't the Shi in Changeling, and what the Tuatha become in the actual mythology is honestly closer to the commoners. So I love the invasion cycle, and I always want to use it, but I'm never quite sure how to use it.
I usually end up going back to the broadest strokes of it, that this is the story of a conquering people, and then them being conquered, and then their conquerors being conquered. I see that really strongly mirrored in the setting information that's provided for North America, where the commoners came over and took America from the Nunahi, and then the Shi came over and took America from the commoners. But there it starts to go a little weird, because after the Accordance War, High King David came to power, and he put in place the Parliament of Dreams, which is a power-sharing institution where the Shi, who represent about 5% of the changeling population in America, control 51% of the seats in the parliament, and the commoners control the other 49%, and the High King, of course, has ultimate authority because it's a kingdom. But they circumvented that in second edition because High King David was lost. He disappeared somewhere while touring his country with his new wife. And in C20, High King David has been found and returned to Concordia, and he's locked himself up in his castle and refuses to engage with leadership at all. So now the Parliament of Dreams factors really heavily into the political structure of Concordia. You have a really interesting twist on the invasion cycle here, because the commoners who were landed and elevated to nobility in order to participate in the Parliament of Dreams have begun to learn sovereign. They've acquired titles and rank that is recognized and enforced by the Dreaming and by their ability to use sovereign on other lower commoners. And there are other places the next invasion could come from in Concordia, the Adheen being a big one, the Shadow Court, the Thalane, the Fomorians. But because of the way World of Darkness goes, the cycle is implied to be broken at this point. It's not that there's going to be another big invasion, unless it's the end of the world. It's that it's going to die from the inside out, from infighting, and from commoners buying into the really toxic powers that they've gotten from their faux nobility.
Well, and I personally think there's a pretty strong story to be told there, that there is a slender, slender chance that the cycle could continue, but the Arcadian Shi are screwing it up. Because if you think about it, every phase of Fae existence, and we've talked about this a lot, has involved a major evolution from unshaped Lord of Chaos to shaped Fair Folk, trying to destroy reality, to the Fair Folk who are addicted to reality, to Firstborn, to Changelings, and so on and so on. And the Autumn Fae were really taking the next step in that process. And then along come the Arcadian Fae, and they reinforce this old structure, and they try to more or less make things the way they were, and they hole up inside their freeholds, and they refuse to move forward. And all of this is really highlighted much more elegantly in C20, and because there is this division and because the invasion cycle has been more heavily emphasized in the backstory. And the feeling I get is very much, you know, to tie back to the broader World of Darkness cosmology, okay, here's this path forward where we wipe out what came before and we become the next thing because you got to move forward. Along comes a spider. Weaver refuses to give up the old. And yes, framing the Arcadian she as an agent of Weaver is weird, but, I mean, heck, the Balorian Crusade is an agent of Wyrm, and everybody thinks of the Fae as wild, so it wouldn't be the first time that the Fae get into a weird place in the Triad that you don't expect them, but really, the commoners were doing really well until the resurgence. And now the Evanescence pushes it back even farther in the reverse of the invasion cycle to forces of the Fomorians. And so, yeah, I mean, the whole train has backed up. But there is a path forward. The Autumn Shi are still there. The Autumn Shi are still engaging with humanity. They just have to figure out a way to just blast past all these fools that refuse to let them move forward.
Right, and that the Fae as an agent of the Weaver ends up tying into the prequel material in Dark Ages Fae, because Dark Ages Fae really solidly establishes that the Fae are capable of doing weaving-type actions in forcing things to become static. Granted, they're probably not the best at it, but they can do it, and now that they're part human, that potential gets a lot bigger. And humans always hate change. And this ties it back into that dynastic impulse we were talking about, where in C20, High King David and his wife, whose name I don't remember because she's not a big deal, they're waiting to give birth to a she-child, which is not the way anything works.
It's not the way anything has ever worked. There's this terrifying implication there that either we're going to give birth to an Autumn Shi child and pretend that that's fine and that the other Arcadian Shi will put up with an Autumn Shi High King, right, meanwhile back on the farm with the sane people, or the alternative is we're going to wait for one of these upsurgents of Shi from the Dreaming, and maybe we have some secret way to hunt them down, maybe High King David discovered that while he was missing, and we're going to arrange to let one of them rip the soul out of our child and take its place because, we're going to fix our politics. It's going to be fine. I really don't know which one of those interpretations I find more horrific for its naivete or its monstrousness. Monstrousness on a character that has been depicted as incredibly kind and seely up until now. It's a really strange plot point.
All right. So, that is what we think of the Shi. This is not the only interpretation of them, and you are welcome to disagree. We know many people personally who do, but hopefully we've given you something to react to and against in your own games, and some material to use as inspiration. As always, I'm Simon Eichhardenschen, and Victor, and we will be back with the next episode, and hopefully we'll have fewer technical difficulties this time.
Yes, just so you all know, we did record several sections of this episode a few times. So, just know, we really devoted ourselves to these elves to get this episode to you.
The readings from this conversation were from The Hosting of the Shi by William Butler Yeats and Fool's Luck, The Way of the Commoner. The music from this episode was LSD by Montplaisir. today's poorly explained echo. Lonfar was a knight whose dagger turned red whenever he lied. Not by magic, of course, but because he had a habit of telling people that they were going to be just fine as he stabbed them in the back.